From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And this morning, we first speak with award-winning science journalist Judith Schwartz about her latest book, The Reindeer Chronicles, and other inspiring stories of working with nature to heal Earth. Now, the book provides an insightful global exploration of promising nature-based techniques for restoring and preserving our soil, water, agricultural systems, and wildlife. Schwartz and her book, The Reindeer Chronicles, in the first part of the show.
Then Nadia Hadman, a journalist with the Center for Investigative Reporting, joins us to discuss the impacts which recent funding pullbacks and proposed funding cuts to the U.S. national parks will have on not just on staff and day-to-day operations, but on the current and future researchers who study wildlife, air, land, and water across our national park system, including those out here in the Mountain West. Environmental awareness and education. That's what This Green Earth is all about.
I want to jump right in because we have so much to talk about with your book, The Reindeer Chronicles, and we are so happy that you could join us here on This Green Earth today. Now, before we jump into that, first, let's get to know you a little bit better. We love to get to know the background on our guests and what compels you to do writings such as this. So tell us a little bit about your background and what inspired you to write this book.
Yeah, so I had been on this path, basically exploring what I felt had been missing from our environmental conversations. So, for example, I wrote a book, the environmental book I wrote was I felt that soil was missing from our conversations, particularly in terms of climate. So I wrote a book about soil. Then I felt water was missing. I wrote a book called Water in Plain Sight, mm-hmm. Hope for a Thirsty World. And the reason I wrote that is that when people made the connection between climate change and water, it only went in one direction, which is that climate change will put added stress on water sources throughout the world, and that is true. But what had been missing was the effect that the water cycle has on climate. Because if you step back and ask, how does the Earth manage heat, it's largely through the water cycle, through mm-hmm. the phase changes of water. It was really exciting, and for people who don't know my work, I explore these scientific concepts through narrative. Mm. Okay, so I wrote those two books, and in the process, I had the extraordinary privilege of seeing incredible ecosystem restoration examples. I've seen ranches where the land had been desertified, and then after years of working with livestock, they're full of life, full of biodiversity, getting more rain than their neighbors, or at least holding on to the rain that they get, mm-hmm. and thriving. So I just felt it was so important to share these stories for many reasons. One is that how can people focus on restoring ecosystems if they don't even know it's possible? It hadn't been part of our conversation. And so much news about the environment is negative, but I knew that this was happening throughout the world. And to share how people are doing this, because these nature-inspired practices can be applied anywhere on any scale, of course, within the context of where you are. So, yeah, that kind of brings us up to the book.
Right.
And we love to talk about hope here, and your book has a lot of hope in it, and we talk about working with nature to heal its own self. And one of the terms that was used, ecological forensics, was really interesting to me in knowing a history of a place to lead to solutions for our landscapes and the impacts that we're having on it. Can you walk us through some of those things?
Yeah, actually, with the perspective I have now, since the book, it's about really understanding a landscape and asking, okay, if a landscape is degraded, mm-hmm. how did it work? What was here that's not here now? How can we regain those functions? That sounds kind of abstract, but here's an example that I know people in the U.S. and the West, actually across the U.S., are finding that bringing beavers back onto the land
right.
is helping to restore the water cycle, helping to keep water in the landscape, create wetlands, and bolster biodiversity, because creating the conditions for many, many species to thrive. So one could have looked at these landscapes and say, what kept this going in the past? What was different in the past when the land was healthier, and how might we recreate those conditions?
Right.
So, yeah, really looking at the landscape and asking what it had been, what it needs, and how one can work in harmony with that place.
Yeah, Judith, it reminds me of some other examples, beavers being a great one. But we've also had interviews with scientists who've looked at the growing populations of otters off the northwest, the Pacific coast, and the impacts their reintroduction or their strengthening populations are having on ecosystems. We've talked to others who have studied oysters in the Chesapeake Bay or off the bayous of Louisiana, and how preserving or in some cases reintroducing those mollusks help to restore ecosystems to the way they once were. So, yeah, the wonderful examples of how nature and reestablishing, as you say, the historic aspects of nature help bring systems back. And then we have to, I guess, maybe we have to change our behaviors sometime, like, for example, towards beavers.
Yeah, well, that's behavior, but the most important part is our perspective.
Yeah.
So rather than just thinking of them as pests, mm-hmm. inquire, how did they function in the landscape? What did they do for us? How might we create that again?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think so much of this is about changing how we're thinking, because so many of us in our daily lives, we are not in direct contact with nature. And there's a collective forgetting of how things were. In fact, many of us spend our lives on degraded landscapes, mm-hmm. and we don't know that because we think it's always been that way.
Right.
But it's interesting you talk about looking back in time, because you can look back, like, way back in time. I have this example in the book and something I've followed really closely in Australia. I keep up with this fellow at Kachana Station, which is a cattle station the size of Singapore. I mean, it's huge. It's crazy. This is like the outback of the outback, mm-hmm. way up in the Kimberley. And so he's been managing cattle, Chris Hengler and his family, they've been managing cattle to restore the landscape because it needed animal impact. And again, all our landscapes have been formed and sustained by life, by the plants, animals, fungi, insects that have lived there. So donkeys showed up, and the government said, well, we don't like donkeys. They're not native to Australia, so we have to get rid of them.
Mm.
But Chris observed that the donkeys were going places where the cattle wouldn't go, and they were eating brush, so there was less fodder for fire,
right.
and they were digging wells and bringing water up for other wildlife. They were doing all these things that were positive, so they were part of the fire crew.
Hmm.
And what they realized, what scientists who studied this realized, is that the donkeys were providing ecological functions that had been void since the end of the late Pleistocene.
Hmm.
So we're talking 40 to 50,000 years ago, when there were giant wombats and diprotons and all these incredible animals that went extinct around that time. So that has a lot to do with why the soil is so thin and nutrient poor in Australia. And so, well, the donkeys can help.
Yes. Even when we, again, have a perspective, as you said, that they're a non-native species, so they don't belong there. So tell us a little bit about what you observed when you were in Norway and a reindeer herder there.
Right, yeah. So that was really interesting, and it really points to the fact that we often misinterpret what's really going on. Okay, so when I was in Norway, there was a law case that was captivating the country. The government said that reindeer herders needed to cull their herds to protect the fragile tundra ecosystem. Mm. And this young man, all of 23, said, "I'm not going to do that because I won't be able, if I cut the numbers, then I won't be able to continue to herd. And that means that no one in my generation will be able to continue this practice that my people have done for thousands of years." So he kept winning cases, and it was really calling attention to the threats to this culture, to the Sami people. And then finally, it went up to the Supreme Court, and he lost. Mm. And that was, you know, of course, very concerning. But one of the reasons I highlight this case is that it turns out the government was wrong, that rather than too many reindeer putting pressure on the ecosystem, the reindeer actually preserve the ecosystem. So the way that works is that in the summer, when the reindeer are doing their summer grazing up in the mountains, they are browsing on shrubs and small trees, and that keeps the trees smaller. And the trees actually were absorbing heat because their leaves were dark, and the reindeer were controlling them and keeping the heath grasslands, which are lighter colored and reflect the heat, keeping them healthy. So that's one thing. And then in the winter, when these animals, people group together and they move the herds across this huge landscape, the reindeer are pressing down on the snow. I mean, they're trampling down the snow. So the snow was acting as an insulator. Mm-hmm. So by trampling it down, they are making it so that the cold air penetrates, so the soil stays frozen. It keeps the permafrost frosty, and that's really important. There's been research that found that way up in the Arctic regions, that the presence of grazing herbivores can keep the temperature down something like 15 degrees Celsius. I mean, it was really pretty extraordinary. That is in the book.
You had touched on this a little bit earlier. We talked about positivity. I think overarchingly through the book, this thread of solutions come with a positive mindset. And if you have this hope and possibility, you have these better outcomes. Can you kind of talk me through that positivity that you put down in the book?
Okay. Yes. Yeah, so this is from a story about a consensus method. It's a story in the book, but it was very, very powerful to see that once you open the door to a possibility, things change. So what you're talking about is, okay, many people are in despair, and okay, it's impossible to solve this problem locally, this particular watershed, it's impossible to do this, it's impossible to do that. But if you shift it and say, okay, given that it is impossible, if it were possible, what would that look like? What would you do? Oh, okay, well, maybe we would remove invasive plants. Maybe we would restore the soil and make an effort to do that. Maybe we'd bring in compost. So once you have one idea, you're already on the path. So if it were possible, what would we do? What might we do? And I think it's so important for us to explore all these ideas, because with everything, all of our environmental challenges, one unknown is the extent to which and the pace at which nature will heal. And I have seen example after example of nature rebounding faster than anyone thought. So to really take in that nature wants to heal herself, that is how all of nature is designed. It's designed to heal and adapt and all of that. And it's so important to have this in our ongoing conversations, including climate conversations, because our ecosystems are what regulates climate. Mm-hmm. So we've kind of ignored that because we've seen, and this is what I share, that even large-scale damaged ecosystems can be restored. And so given that we know that, we can restore at least some component of that climate regulation. So what are we waiting for? And the truth is that a lot of people aren't waiting. A right. lot of people are doing work
right.
to enhance the health of where they are.
So, Judith, I hate to have to end this because I know we got started a little bit late, but I love this thought process about looking to how nature has healed itself. And I appreciate you coming on our show today. Right. The book is called The Reindeer Chronicles and Other Inspiring Stories of Working with Nature to Heal the Earth. And where can people go to learn more about you, your writing, and perhaps get their hands on a book?
Yeah, so my website is judithdschwartz.com, and the publisher of these books is Chelsea Green, chelseagreenpublishing.com, and they usually have a sale going. So, and then, of course, I always recommend that people go to their local bookstores
right.
because that really matters. They're such important parts of our community.
That's an intellectual ecosystem that we really need to preserve and conserve
and
foster.
That's right. Well, Judith, we will have you back on the show because your writings are so wonderful, and I would love to talk to you more. So we'll have you back on this Green Earth, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Judith.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And now we have the honor of introducing you to Nadia Hamden, who is a journalist with the Center for Investigative Reporting. And Nadia is joining us to discuss the impacts which recent funding pullbacks and proposed funding cuts to U.S. national parks will have on the current and future researchers who study wildlife, air, land, and water across our national park system. And Nadia also has been involved with the NPR station and a reporter.
Yes.
So fellow reporter.
And a podcast.
Nadia, thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so you're working on this report for Reveal. It is a podcast, and we are really interested to do a little bit more of a deep dive on what your discoveries are. First, though, we do want to get a background on you because you have a very interesting background and you've done a lot of investigative journalism. So talk us through why it was so important for you to go into this field and why maybe even today it seems really important to be in a field like this.
Oh, goodness. I think it's, you know, more important than ever not to parrot what so many people have said. We live in a time where we want things quickly, and I understand that, but sometimes the best reporting takes time. It takes a little bit of energy to find the things that we really do need to understand. And I think, you know, especially given how much is happening, how much is coming out of not just the White House, but just the amount of news alerts that we get every day. Sometimes it's really important to take a step back and make sure that we actually understand the news alerts that are being, you know, pinged to our phones every day. And I think that's kind of what investigative reporting brings, is a step back and a deeper look so that we can make sure that we are getting the full picture of a lot of these stories. And so, yeah, I just think it's so important, and I'm grateful to be able to do it in some part.
So the story focuses on the national parks, the U.S. national park system, and not just the proposed funding cuts, but actually the White House has kind of clawed back or rescinded. Am I have this right? $267 million for things like park improvements and research, mm-hmm. et cetera. So give us some details with respect to what that means.
Yeah, so really what brought me to this story is I've been seeing in the news a ton about how visitorship is going to be potentially impacted, which, of course, justifiably people are concerned about that. Mm. But I kept wondering, what does that mean for conservation efforts, since that is a huge part of the mission of the national parks? It's actually in the law. And so, you know, I reached out to the National Parks Conservation Association, which has been the oldest watchdog group for national parks in order to protect national parks. And, you know, through working with them and talking with 20 different people, both in and around national parks, current and former employees, superintendents, directors, people who work closely with wildlife, I was able to kind of glean that the big issue here is not only has, you know, the National Park Service lost about a quarter of its staff since January, and just to put that in perspective, it's lost like 20% of its staff since 2010, and within just a few months, it lost more than that. So it's just lost a huge amount of staff, right? And there's a hiring freeze in place, which means that they can't hire and fill those positions that are lost. So there's just been a giant brain drain, right? And on top of that, you have, you know, this $267 million that was clawed back, as you mentioned, from Trump's big, beautiful bill that would have gone to the National Park Service and gone to things like conservation and science research. But then we also have, like, these tentacles that I don't think many people are aware of, is that things like the National Science Foundation, the Environmental Protection Agency, these agencies fund a lot of research in national parks, and those agencies are seeing their budgets potentially get cut by more than half this coming year. So if the Trump administration gets its way, we're going to see so much funding cuts. We're already seeing, outgoing funding for places like the National Science Foundation, you know, frozen. So, for example, someone was sharing a story with me of, you know, two New Zealand muggers who, you know, are tasked with capturing a moose and tracking it, right? They were able to pay for something like that through a grant from the National Science Foundation in the past, and now it doesn't look like they would be able to do that.
Hmm. Yeah, when you say brain drain and you're taking away the people that are informing us and telling us what's happening out there with our landscapes and in these places, you just gave us a little bit of a descriptor there, but what does this mean for our national parks if we do take away these people that are working so hard to maintain these landscapes?
Sure. So that was kind of the biggest worry I felt from so many people, right? As I said, I spoke to 20 different people, and many of these people are biologists and ecologists, and they basically were just all expressing a lot of anxiety to me, since these are just kind of unprecedented cuts. And basically, like so many of your listeners, I'm sure know, like with science, it's not good to play fast and loose with science, right? You want to stay consistent. You want to be there every day, day in, day out, to make sure that you're monitoring the environment fully, right? And so the National Parks Conservation Association actually started compiling a list of the different programs that might be most damaged by these cuts, programs that it thinks could be most damaged. And interestingly, things like, I was very surprised to see something like the Yellowstone Wolf Project on there, right? Mm-hmm. So for people who are not familiar, I mean, we're actually in the 30th anniversary of the reintroduction of wolves into Yellowstone after we pretty much lost them. And so it's kind of like this crowning conservation achievement associated with the national parks. And then to see that as one of 16 potential long-term research programs that could be impacted by these cuts, you know, it's very concerning, right? Because as people know, wolves have a huge impact on the environment. They affect the rivers. They affect the trees. If you all go back to your biology classes and remember the trophic cascade, it's all connected. And so I think the concern is, you know, even, you know, losing one person who's been doing this work for however many years really does impact the kind of like longstanding research that a lot of these people rely on. And, you know, one air quality supervisor put it to me, because, you know, the National Air Quality Monitoring System is also on that list of potentially, you know, damaged programs. They put it to me that they have to take a sample each week, an air sample each week. And if they were to miss just 3 weeks of that, the entire year's data would be considered invalid. So it's just kind of keeping in mind how important and how important it is to make sure this stuff is not interrupted. And I think what people are so worried about is that it might be with all of these staffing and funding cuts.
This brain drain, again, is some of it a result of layoffs, or is there some part of it where scientists are saying, I'm out of here, you know, I'll go work somewhere else?
Yes, I'm glad you bring that up, because I think the main, because as of right now, we're still waiting to see what the budget will ultimately be. There's the Trump administration's budget, there's the House budget, and there's the Senate budget, and they're all different.
Right.
So we're kind of anxiously waiting to see what happens. But I think the main concern right now is that brain drain, is the loss of staff, because not only, you know, we've lost it through firings, we've lost it through, you know, just plain old attrition, buyouts. I think a lot of people have heard about this stuff. But something that was brought up to me that we don't stop to appreciate is that, like you just said, you know, the National Park Service was a dream job, or is a dream job, for so many conservationists. But right now, with all this upheaval, it really is making it less so. So, you know, the National Parks Conservation Association was telling me people are looking for other jobs. You know, they don't know if they want to go somewhere where they might arbitrarily be fired. Because even though many of these people were rehired when they were originally fired back in February, the Supreme Court in July cleared the way for those firings to happen again. So the Trump administration can fire all those probationary workers that were just rehired again, and they can do even further and deeper cuts to the NPS. And I think that's the big concern. Even, you know, I spoke to a carnivore biologist named Andrea Townsend, who was fired and then rehired.
Yeah.
And while she's very happy to have her job back, I mean, she expressed that there's not one federal worker right now who is not terrified that they might lose their job again. They don't feel secure in their position. And that impacts the passion that they once had for doing this work.
Right. So you mentioned a gray wolf program at risk, air quality monitoring programs at risk, other, like, I don't get, you say there's like 16 research programs you analyzed or took a look at. Anything that's, say, marine-based or wetland systems? I mean, it cuts across the board, I'm sure.
It cuts across the board. Yeah, we have, you know, we have, like, I learned about, you know, two fish biologists at Olympic National Park who were tasked with monitoring salmon and steelhead across 4,000 miles of river at Olympic. You know, they were let go. You have, you know, Channel Islands inventory and monitoring programs at risk. It really does run the gamut. I mean, it when I looked at this list provided to me by the National Parks Conservation Association, I was quite surprised to see that those our programs that they're looking at and are fearful might really be impacted either by staffing or funding cuts. And, you know, the other reason for this, even though, yes, these programs, I will say again, are not gone yet. I think the main concern I kept hearing from everybody I spoke to is the reason they're even more worried is also because they're seeing budget proposals for similar programs across other public land agencies getting slashed. Mm. So, for example, if the Trump administration gets its way, the entire research arm of the U.S. Forest Service would be gone, the U.S. Geological Survey Ecosystem Studies Unit would be gone, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's conservation funds, all of them, would be gone. So that's just unprecedented for most of these biologists and ecologists to see their, you know, their colleagues at these other agencies might see their entire programs completely demolished. So that's what's causing a lot of the fear for the National Park System. I think the National Park System carries a lot of political weight, and so it's probably going to be the last to be touched. But I do fear that with an administration that's very much seems to be anti-science and research and climate change, they're worried that that could be next on the chopping block.
Nadia, tell us a little bit about REVEAL and the Center for Investigative Reporting.
Oh, thanks for asking. So the REVEAL and now the Center for Investigative Reporting, I mean, we've been a podcast and radio show for many, many years. We focus on investigative reporting. We recently merged with Mother Jones, and so we have an even bigger team of investigative reporters trying to bring you deeper looks at the news of the day. But we are pretty dedicated. We're a nonprofit, and we really, really value this medium, you know, being able to tell stories through audio. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if there's more you want to know, but, you know, we're still here and we're still doing investigative work for now, and that's good. What matters.
Absolutely. And I think educating people and getting people excited or involved in protecting the planet. We just talked to an author who wrote a book that discusses understanding our past, understand our future. So when I look at something along these lines and think about what it will do for education, because when I was a kid, that's what made me care. That's what made me want to get involved or do things to help Mother Nature. So I fear what this looks like for the next generation and how we're educating them around the planet.
Right. And I think that's kind of what I heard from so many people is, you know, we don't go to these places for the clean bathrooms. You know, we go to these places because we really, I mean, they're beautiful, yes, but also kind of interacting with wildlife, getting to see these kind of beautiful scenes. Like, it really just kind of reminds you that we are a part of this world, not mm-hmm. separate from it. And I do think that so many people have said to me in their own way of like their first moment of going to a national park and kind of having that realization and feeling so connected to it all. And I think that's why we go to these places, you know. We also go to these places to kind of escape the news and politics and kind of step back into kind of this more natural world. And I think the concern for everyone is like, you know, are we going to lose that nature? Are we going to lose that wildness? And, you know, the National Park Service has 600 endangered and threatened species that live on that land. And I think a lot of people want to make sure they stick around. And the only way to do that is for those biologists and ecologists and other scientists who do the day in, day out work that maybe often goes unseen, but needs to keep happening in the background, right? In order for you guys to get that glimpse of a wolf or see a bison or elk or whatever species you're most curious about. So, I think this is really more of a cautionary tale right now, but we're waiting to see what happens.
Well, one other thing that's maybe hopeful is that fact that at least in the Senate, Nadia, there seems to be senators from both red and blue states who recognize and appreciate, understand the value that a healthy national park system, healthy environments play for their states, not only just as a natural resource, but even on economic scales, you know, go to Alaska, go to Maine, go to Wyoming, come to Utah.
Right.
There is a lot of money that is made via the national park system. So the concerns, hopefully, cut across both red and blue states. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the point you're making is very important, and it's why a lot of people are very confused by these cuts, because, yeah. You know, the National Park Service, you know, takes up such a small portion of the larger budget and yet brings in a lot more money than it takes. And so people are kind of scratching their head at this decision. But like you said, I mean, I don't know I'm sure you guys are familiar with this program. You know, Senator Mike Lee of Utah actually tried to put in the Trump's Big Beautiful Bill a proposal to sell public land. Mm-hmm. I think it was about 1.2 million acres of public land in the, you know, Bureau of Land Management, not even within the national park system.
Right.
And the public backlash was so severe from both sides of the aisle that they removed it from the bill. So I think that says a lot about people's love for public land, not just within the national parks, but in the Forest Service, in BLM. People really want to keep public land in the hands of the public, and they want to make sure that it sticks around. And that's why I think we're curious to see what happens, because I think the government has definitely been sent a signal that says we should keep this around. And like you said, the Senate bill is kind of reflecting that. You know, there was Trump's proposed budget cut, which was so severe, and then the House budget cut was slightly less, and then we kind of got like this third porridge just right with the Senate, according to the people who want to see the Senate bill move forward, which would just keep flat funding, right? It wouldn't really touch or cut anything out that is already there. So yeah, we're waiting to see. But I do think that this is definitely a bipartisan issue. People love their national parks. The poll after poll shows that national parks are beloved.
Right.
And so we're just waiting to see if the funding continues so that we can keep the national parks conserved for not just this generation, but future generations.
All right. We got like one more minute. And of course, I'll ask you a 3-minute question. But going back to the research programs, I got a text saying, OK, the two guys that do salmon and steelhead monitoring, their program gets canceled. So what? What does that mean? On a larger scale, does it impact the steelhead and salmon populations? What's the impact of canceling these programs? You have 1 minute.
Sure. I mean, if in 1 minute, I'll just say, you know, the people who do this stuff, it's not so simple to understand the 4,000 miles of river that are in Olympic National Park. It takes a lot of time on that land, within that water, to really understand it. And so it's not so simple of, oh, we're just going to fire this person and rehire this person. You're getting rid of people with really, really deep institutional knowledge. And I think that's the concern I kept hearing from everybody, is like, when you fire that person, it's not so simple. There's not somebody waiting in the wings to be rehired. And I think that's the concern, is that what do we then lose when we lose that person and their institutional knowledge?
Good.
Well,
great.
Nadia Hamden, a journalist with the Center for Investigative Reporting, also going to be reporting for Reveal podcast. When does this come out, Nadia? When can people hear this story?
This will come out this Saturday, actually.
Oh, perfect.
Wonderful. So we appreciate you coming on this Green Earth and talking to us more about your investigations and the importance of them, and also what is the potential of some of these rollbacks and the power of the people as well. I think we covered all of that, which I think is really important. And thank you so much for being a part of our programming. And if people want to learn more about you and some of your other reports, what could they do? Is there a website they could go to?
Yes, you can just go to revealnews.org and you can find me there, and you could see any of my other work. But thank you guys so much. I appreciate you taking the time to talk about this.
Thank you. Thank you for your work.
Thanks, Nadia.
Be in touch. Thanks, Nadia.